I had the good fortune of receiving an email from a yogi that I was practicing with recently. And she described her, the second half of her retreat was starting. So she had sat for about 3 full days. And that retreat wrapped up. And she said, okay, the second part of my retreat is starting. So she sent me an email saying, and she noticed that things were a little different. Weren't so agitating. They actually weren't agitating at all. In fact, she said she had gone into a coffee shop to get some coffee, that the lid wasn't securely on the coffee, the top. So she went to take a sip and the lid fell off and the coffee ended up spilling and she spilled some on her shirt. She said she wasn't even irritated. Normally she'd be irritated, but she wasn't. She got something to clean it up with. And I think the person who had been serving her the coffee, the person, the employee, said like, oh, you got some coffee on your shirt. In this retreat that she had been sitting, they were contemplating the first establishment of mindfulness and an integral practice of that first establishment or cemetery contemplation. So reflecting on our own death and the fact that our time here is finite. So this employee at the coffee shop says, oh, you got some coffee on your shirt. She said, you know, I'm headed to the cemetery and the people there won't care whether I have coffee on my shirt. And it was humorous because she actually wasn't on her way to the cemetery, right? She was going to go back home. But having spent 3 days with this first establishment of mindfulness and reflecting on her own death, to her it felt like all of humanity, everyone, no matter our age, our social kind of placement, economic status, our sexual orientation, our gender expression, our family upbringing, our family configuration, our religious upbringing, our ethnicity, our race, like everybody is headed to the cemetery. And in the moment when I was reading it, it was quite humorous and I laughed out loud, but there's something very profound in what she was saying. No one's going to care whether I have coffee on my shirt when I head to the cemetery. And that we're all on our way. And it, to me, it spoke to the possibility of, wow, no one's gonna care. I'm not gonna care whether I have coffee or what I look like or the small things of life. And perhaps because once I get to the cemetery, no one's going to care. Like on my way there, is there the possibility of starting to let go of some of our concerns and entanglements and agitation? Like on our way to the cemetery, like no one's going to care what I said in that meeting or how I look. So if it's not going to matter there, is there the possibility that on the way to the cemetery, I can start to let go of some of these preoccupations that agitate the heart? That get us caught up in anxiety. Get us. Entangled in exuberance and not being present to our lives. We're all on our way to the cemetery. And on May 13th, our day long, our hybrid day long, which to say, I was thinking about us all being together in the same room. It's been so long since we've actually all been together as a Sangha. Yes, there was a moment, a few more than a few moments, where my mind was not with the breath, and this thought came of us being together. I just got so happy thinking of us at St. Luke's Church, practicing together, supported. It just made me so happy. And I thought, she's going to have a hard time not hugging people. I can't. I'm so looking forward to us being together. On May 13th, we'll be practicing with this first establishment of mindfulness. It's interesting because we could do all four establishments, and the four establishments, Satipatthana, this foundational teaching of the Buddha, where he's encouraging us to come into right relationship with our bodies, the play of Vedana, different mind states and dhammas, and we'll start to unpack this tonight. So for the day long, we could actually go through all four establishments. It would be a lot. Be a lot to cover in a day. But we could do it. We could do it. But my heart felt called to really work with this first establishment, the establishment of the body. It's partly because there are six practices that are a part of this first establishment of mindfulness, and all four of these establishments are a way of not only arousing mindfulness, but developing and strengthening sati, mindfulness, which is our best friend. It's the one factor of mind that is a support for us no matter where we are on the path. If we're at the beginning, the middle, or the end, mindfulness is our best friend. So it makes sense that the Buddha would offer us practices that arouse mindfulness and help mindfulness to become strong so that it becomes an awakening factor. By awakening factor, we know mindfulness becomes an awakening factor when it's unremitting. Like you couldn't stop the mindfulness if you wanted to. There's just so much momentum behind it. So all four establishments help us to arouse mindfulness and to strengthen it. So it makes sense to have a day long that really works with all four of them. But I felt called to work with this first establishment because there are six practices around the body, and we touch the first three. In your standard retreats, where we really work with breath, the postures of the body, standing, sitting, walking, lying down, and the body and its various activities. But it's so rare that we then turn that mindfulness to the nature of the body and starting to come into a right relationship with the body and its anatomical parts, the not self nature of the body. And the fact that this body, when it breathes its last breath, will fall apart. It will die and it will fall apart. And that's not a morbid thing. It's when we really give ourselves over to that practice, it can be a source of joy and gladness and precision. It can help us cut out the extraneous things of our lives that aren't connected to the through line of our intention, our aspirations for our life, for our practice. So very powerful practices. And because we so rarely practice with cemetery contemplations and the empty nature of the body and the construct of beauty that we attribute to bodies. I just wanted to dedicate time to it. I also wanted to dedicate time to the first establishment of mindfulness because it feels so connected to this beautiful mind state of equanimity, this equipoise of mind and heart that is non-reactive. And when I say that, it sounds like womp, womp, womp. Equanimity. That's not as kind of juicy or exciting as loving kindness or compassion or sympathetic joy or resonant joy. There's something so superb about equanimity. This heart that's non-reactive. And that is so non-reactive that it allows the other three Brahma Viharas to move on through. Like there's such stability in the heart mind, and there's such a deep okayness and peace that friendliness can move through when friendliness is called for, or compassion can move through the heart when suffering elicits that force, when compassion is the appropriate response. That there's so much peace in the heart that when there's good fortune or beauty, and we see the goodness of another human being, like the heart celebrates and mudita comes rolling through. Equanimity, I've found the more I practice with the four establishments of mindfulness, especially this first establishment around the body, there's a real equipoise, balance, non-reactivity in the mind, like an okayness with the body and its ultimate fate. So I'm really looking forward to our day long on May 13th. And just to kind of start to orient our hearts to the practices that we'll be doing on, did I say May 31st? I think it's May 13th, but I may have said the 31st. I'm sorry, I meant the 13th. So on May 13th, to start to orient our heart to this first establishment of mindfulness, I just want to give us an overview of the Satipatthana, the four Satipatthanas. In a way, each of the Satipatthanas helps to cultivate this equanimity, learning to be non-reactive. And it's not learning. Well, it is a learning, but it's an organic learning, right? Just by virtue of engaging with the second establishment of mindfulness, so Vedana, this feeling tone, we allow ourselves to know it directly in our experience, in the body, in the heart mind, and not be blown around by it so that there's a steadiness. Again, this theme of balance, equanimity, that we know the mind in its various mind states. We see them clearly and we're not blown around by them. And then we start to come into a deep understanding of the five hindrances, the five aggregates, the six sense gates, the awakening factors, and the four noble truths. And practicing with them in such a way that the heart becomes okay with life as it is. So threaded throughout the four establishments of mindfulness is this equanimity that arises organically from just practicing with the four establishments. Just as this woman had emailed me to say, you know, normally I'd be agitated, but I'm not. That absence of agitation is a taste of equanimity within her own heart and mind. She is in that moment, she was directly experiencing some measure of equipoise, equanimity, balance of mind, in the balance of mind that could make a connection with the cemetery practices and be humorous about it. Okay with death. Okay with spilling coffee on her shirt. Okay with spilling coffee on the floor. Okay. And okayness. And she wasn't in that retreat. Her aim was not to cultivate equanimity. It was a byproduct from engaging the practice. So thought we'd just dive in and start to orient ourselves to Satipatthana, these four establishments of mindfulness. The Buddha talks about it as the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method for the realization of nibbana, namely the four satipatthanas, namely these four establishments of mindfulness. Every time I think of the four establishments of mindfulness and that, how the Buddha describes it, I am so moved. And also, like, Buddha, like, you are, like, that is such a bold proclamation. This is the direct path, not a circuitous path, but the direct path, straight line. This is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance. He doesn't say like waning away. He doesn't say like it gets attenuated. The disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method, for the realization of nibbana, a heart mind that is completely free of greed, aversion, and delusion. Namely, the four satipatthanas. Chantaro Satipatthana. And you engage in the practice and you recognize, yeah, it does lead to full awakening because you feel sorrow, lamentation, dukkha starting to be attenuated. We feel into these moments directly of tranquility and feeling like, okay, when greed, aversion, and delusion have abated in my heart, this is what freedom tastes like. There's humor here. There's equanimity. There's happiness. There's contentment. And even when there is greed, aversion, and delusion in the mind, and we see it for what it is, there can be an equanimity around that, a balance around the reactivity, a mind that isn't so agitated by the agitation, as Philip Moffat would say, comfort with the discomfort. So the first establishment is a, as I said, the body, these six practices, which we'll be really working with on our day long on May 13th. And then we have the second establishment, Vedana, contemplation of feeling tone. And it's, some of you know and some of you may not know, I'm not sure. It's not a, Vedana isn't an emotion. It's this basic movement of the heart. We feel into experience every moment of experience, every moment of a sight, a sound, a smell, taste, sensation of the body, a mind state. There's some Vedana, there's some feeling tone. The heart feeling into the experience and being like, oh, that's pleasant. That's unpleasant. It's neither pleasant or unpleasant. It's neutral. So we have these three responses to sense door experience. Sense door experience being sight, sound, smells, taste, sensations of the body, heart, mind, state. And there's this response of, oh, that's pleasant. Oh, that's more than pleasant. That's really pleasurable. Or that's unpleasant. And it's a range, right? It's unpleasant to like intensely painful. Or it's neutral. Three ways of feeling into experience. And the reason, or it's thought one of the reasons the Buddha gave Vedana its own establishment for us to really start to arouse mindfulness in relationship to Vedana and then start to understand the nature of Vedana is because when we attend to Vedana and we notice, oh, this is pleasant, this is unpleasant, this is neither pleasant nor unpleasant, it's neutral, we're not as likely to tumble into and be pushed into craving, aversion, or craving. And craving is a, in the suttas, it's a shorthand for this interplay of greed, aversion, and delusion. So we don't get pulled into the pleasant Vedana. It could be so pleasant that we just collapse around it and we want it to stay static and we want to keep it. That's the manifestation of greed. There's unpleasant Vedana, we can fall, we can be pushed into aversion, wanting to push it away, not liking. Or if it's kind of neutral, it's neither pleasant or unpleasant, kind of space out, get confused, move into ignorance, not really understanding the significance of the experience, seeing its three characteristics, seeing its not self, unsatisfactory, and oh my goodness, not self, unsatisfactory, and impermanent, changing nature. Vedana that's neutral, we can lose sight of the three characteristic quality of experience. In fact, that's the case with craving as well, greed and aversion. We lose sight of the three characteristic nature of experience. So with the Vedana, when we bring mindfulness to this movement and this play of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, we're less likely to be pushed into craving, right? And I love this word push. It feels like there's a link between Vedana and craving that we rarely talk about, that we can experience directly. And that's chetana, this impulse, this intention. And when you hang out with Vedana enough, and you bring mindfulness to, wow, this is really pleasant. Well, this is really pleasurable. But this is intensely painful, right? When we bring mindfulness to that, we can notice the chetana that arises around it, this intention. It feels like a push in the mind. This is something that I learned from Venerable Inalio to kind of look out for. We're with Vedana, and if it's unpleasant to intensely painful, you may notice an intention arise to alleviate the unpleasant, to alleviate the intensely unpleasant. Right? So perhaps during the meditation earlier today, meditating, you're with the breath, and you notice an ache in the knee. And if you're not aware of the vedana, the unpleasant feeling tone associated with the ache in the knee, you could easily flip into craving, wanting to push it away. Aversion in the mind arises. And you start to identify with the pain in the knee. Oh, my body's starting to fall apart. Maybe I'm going to have like knee surgery in a couple of years. I can't afford that because I'm going to be in bed all for like months at a time, and I won't be able to go to work. So the mind starts to proliferate and creates a reality out of that. And when we're just aware of unpleasant, there's the contact with the sensation, the unpleasant ache in the knee, and we're just aware of unpleasant, right? And then if we pay attention, we'll notice chetna arise. We'll notice this intention, this impulse to alleviate the pain. And there's nothing wrong with that. We just want to be aware of that impulse. Because when we're not, we easily flip over into craving. This, and when I say craving, again, talking about the interplay that the word craving is synonymous with, this interplay of greed, aversion, and delusion. You notice the ache in the knee, the chetna that arises to just move the knee to alleviate the pain. Where there's pleasant, we or with the breath, the attention moves from the breath to some pleasant fantasy. And we don't notice the pleasant vedana associated with that fantasy. And the impulse that arises for, want more. And then we're caught up in craving, chasing that fantasy, continuing to indulge it, right? But if we can wake up within the fantasy, notice, pleasant. Oh, here's the impulse to like continue with this fantasy. I do not want to stop. I just want to keep this rolling. Can we actually just stay mindful of this pleasant fantasy, pleasant, the chetna? And if you stay with the chetna, this Pali word for impulse, intention, it has a push to it. You can feel it in your heart, in your body, to move the leg, which is fine if you move the leg. Just know that that's what you're doing. Bring mindfulness to it. It's okay to recognize the impulse to just want to continue with that fantasy. Just bring mindfulness to that. Feel the push. It's the link between the vedana and being propelled, blown into craving. I use the word blown because in the suttas, vedana is likened to winds blowing through the sky. Winds blowing from the four cardinal directions, blowing in from the east, blowing in from the west, the north, the south. Talk about winds that are cold. Talk about winds that are hot. Dustless winds and dusty winds. So it's speaking to the changing nature of vedana. This play of, and you may notice this when you're resting with mindfulness, being with the breath, noticing the contentment of just being with the breath, and you check, you turn mindfulness towards the vedana. And you notice, it's really pleasant being in contact with the breath. Then you notice 1 second it's neutral. And then you notice a little twinge in your ribs as the on the inhale of the breath. And then it's unpleasant, right? So vedana is constantly shifting and changing. But we're not aware of it. Can we bring mindfulness to the changing, a fluid nature of vedana instead of being pushed around by it? Instead of being pushed around by it, and we stand steady. In the middle of these changing winds, here's the equanimity. Awake knowing, oh, and sometimes maybe you notice this, you're outside, the wind is blowing, it's cold, and you feel your body brace against the cold. Sometimes that happens for me and I'll just notice, it's just unpleasant Vedana, sweetie. So I'm with the cold wind. But I notice when I bring mindfulness to the feeling tone that's arising in response to the cold wind, it shifts. It's unpleasant, but then it's like, I'm always surprised when, because I just assume that cold wind, unpleasant. But if I track the experience, I'm there with it, I see like, it's pleasant. Oh, it moves into, or it's unpleasant, and then it moves into pleasant. Oh, it's neutral. Oh, no, it's intensely unpleasant right now. No, it's painful. I do not like being cold. I do not like being cold. Tipped into craving. Identifying. Liking, disliking experience. There's the loss of the equanimity. And when we just rest mindful, aware of the play of Vedana, moving from pleasant, neutral, unpleasant, tensely pleasurable. There's a balance that comes through just being mindful, just knowing the experience directly. Just noticing the time. Not even on the third establishment. This is why I'd never be able to do a day long on all four establishments, because they are so rich and there's so much to share about each one. So maybe we'll have a day long where we just practice with Vedana and we practice with this pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And then we start to notice worldly forms of Vedana and unworldly forms of Vedana. It's a rich practice. Very, very rich. So maybe we'll have a day long where we work with that. I don't have enough time to unpack all of that. So planting the seeds for the future. Maybe we'll have a day long where we get to work with just Vedana. Then we have the mind. This third establishment, Chitta Nupassi, contemplating the mind. So I just want to read a passage from the Majjhima Nikaya that describes this practice. And I'm going to change the pronoun he to they, she, and he, because not everyone in our Sangha here online, but also our broader Sangha, not everyone identifies in the gender binary of he, she. And how practitioners does a practitioner abide contemplating mind as mind? Here, practitioner understands a mind affected by lust as a mind affected by lust. A mind unaffected by lust as a mind unaffected by lust. They understand mind affected by hate as a mind affected by hate. And mind unaffected by hate as a mind unaffected by hate. She understands mind affected by delusion as a mind affected by delusion. And mind unaffected by delusion as a mind unaffected by delusion. He understands contracted mind as a contracted mind and a distracted mind as a distracted mind. And then goes on to talk about mind as exalted and unexalted, surpassed and unsurpassed, concentrated, unconcentrated, liberated, unliberated. I love this note from Bhikkhu Bodhi. So the note that he has on this practice, it says, mind, chitta, as an object of contemplation, refers to the general state and level of consciousness. Never heard it articulated in this way, and I love it. Mind as an object of contemplation refers to the general state and level of consciousness. Since consciousness itself, in its own nature, is the bare knowing or cognizing of an object, the quality of any state of mind is determined by its associated mental factors. So in this contemplation, we're instructed to know the mental factors. What's coloring the mind? What's coloring this bare knowing? What's coloring the consciousness? I.e., there's this bare knowing of sight, sound, smells, tastes, sensations of the body. But what's the filter through which we're actually knowing that experience? Is there greed? Is there aversion? Is there delusion? Is there the absence of those things? Is there concentration in the mind? Is the mind unconcentrated? Is it distracted? Is it undistracted? Is it liberated? Is it unliberated? What are the mind states that are shaping how we experience and know the world? That's the trying to roll through these fairly quickly. There's so much more to say about the third establishment of mindfulness and Vedana and the first establishment of mindfulness of the body. We're really wanting to respect our time. And then with the fourth establishment, the Dhamma, we're really getting to know what are the ways of relating to our moment-to-moment experience, whether we're looking at it through the five hindrances or the five aggregates or the six sense gates or the seven factors of awakening or the Four Noble Truths. How do we engage with them, practice with these in such a way that we move towards awakening and move away from suffering? So it's like a deep experiential dive into wise effort, mitigating the unwholesome and abandoning the unwholesome and arousing and strengthening the wholesome in relationship to the five aggregates or in relationship to the five hindrances. So these four establishments of the body, feeling, tone, mind, dhammas. As I said, they support us in arousing mindfulness and then turning that very mindfulness towards the body, feeling, tone, the mind, and dhammas, and understanding the nature of them as it relates to supporting us in moving towards awakening. How do we relate to Vedana in such a way that it's liberative? How do we relate to the body in such a way that it's liberative? How do we relate to these mind states that are coloring consciousness in a way that it's liberative? And when we do so, we move into our inheritance of freedom, the byproduct of just engaging with these four satipatthanas. This is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method, for the realization of nibbana. These four satipatthanas, these four establishments of mindfulness. I know that was a very quick tour. There's so much more to say about it. And if you feel called to practice with the four establishments of mindfulness, feel free to pick up any Venerable Anolio's recorded guided meditations or any of his books and scholarship on the four establishments of mindfulness. Super helpful. And if you're interested in learning how to work with all six of the practices that are part of the first establishment of mindfulness of the body, feel free to come to the day long on May 13th. It would be a delight to practice with you in person. I'll do my best not to tackle you all when I see you. I'll be so happy to practice together.